The one thing that I've learned in life is nobody likes change, and everyone will do everything that they can not to change. But change is always good, and out of change, great things always happen. And I think that you need to challenge yourself and get yourself out of your comfort zone and make the changes necessary, because that's how to stay alive in this industry. Constantly change.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Much has changed in the hospitality sector. Not just the colour and vibrancy of different cuisines and the rolling evolution of gastronomy, but the way restaurants function, the culture, the environment, the way career paths are created, and not like they once were. How much have things changed, and what impact does that have on those that grew up on the old world of hospitality and are now success stories in the new world of hospitality? Michael Lambie is an award-winning chef and restaurateur and one of Australia's very best chefs. Michael, how are you?
I'm great, Anthony. Great to be on.
It's great to have you on. Your influence is astounding, both in the UK and Australia, but your career has really been all about change and evolution.
That's right. I think, it's been a funny career, and I haven't always thought that I was going to change and innovate, but it's just the way things have rolled for me since the beginning.
Well, your influence in Australia has been astonishing, but you're from the UK originally. When did you first get interested in food?
That's a good question. I actually grew up in the hospitality industry. My mum and dad were publicans, and they owned a huge pub in Basildon in Essex, and I just sort of got interested in the drinks and the food side from a very, very early age. For pocket money, I used to help out in the kitchen. So I used to sort of peel all the potatoes, and we had a big like chipping machine. So I used to cut all the chips and wash all the salads. And, you know, there was about five cooks that worked there. And I kind of just sort of got really interested in food and the sort of hospitality culture, and it sort of just grew from there. And I'm talking, Anthony, when I was like 12 years old.
Wow.
This was, yeah. So I kind of always had a path. I always knew that I was going to be involved in the hospitality industry in some way, shape or form.
When you got your qualifications, you actually, at a really young age, left the UK. Tell us why that happened and what you did.
Well, what happened, I'll tell you, the story was that I'd done my apprenticeship at Claridge's in London, and I started my apprenticeship when I was 17, and the head chef there, his name was John Williams. He had a huge influence on my career, and, you know, working as a 17-year-old first-year apprentice chef in a kitchen like Claridge's with, you know, 100 chefs in it was pretty daunting. And I couldn't even tie my apron up, let alone hold a knife properly. But I kind of got really interested in the whole culture of the kitchen and the way that it was all running, and you know, the commies and the apprentices and the chef de parties, and it was really, really classical there. And Mr. Williams, he kind of set me on my path. He kind of said to me, you know, if you want to be really good, you need to knuckle down, you need to learn the basics, you need to get yourself overseas, you need to see it all. And I kind of started reading books, and it all sort of just grew from there. Like, it was amazing.
And you ended up in Munich for a little while.
Yeah, so from there, the executive chef, Mario Lesnik, He got me a position working in Munich in Germany, which was in a two-star restaurant called the Königshof. And, you know, that was just absolutely unbelievable. I I went over to Munich as a, you know, an 18-year-old kid, had no idea. My mum was telling me not to go, but, you know, the actual organisation and the food was just like next level, you know, and it was a hard place to work, the Königshof. It was really, really busy, which was something that I never sort of envisaged. I always thought that these great restaurants would be really kind of quite manageable and quiet, but it was busy, and I absolutely loved it. And I met an Australian guy there that actually put me in contact with Mr. Roux at the Waterside Inn, and it was Waterside Inn, 3 Michelin stars. And I wrote them a letter, because back then there wasn't emails. I wrote them a letter, and they gave me a trial, and I actually went back to the UK for Christmas, and I had a trial at the Waterside Inn, and got the job. They said to me, you can start in February on Valentine's Day. I just sort of dropped everything from Germany and went back to the UK and went to the Waterside Inn, and you know, another step up in kind of organization and the way that the kitchen was run and the cleaning everything all the time. And I, you know, I started there, and I kind of, by that time, I really had the bug. And I actually stayed there for 3 years, and, you know, I worked in the larder section, and I done hot entrees, and I done the back of fish, like filleting fish, and learning all that side of it. And then I was chef de partie on the fish section, which was an amazing experience. And from there, I had a colleague of mine that was working at Harvey's, which was Marco Pierre White. And I got an opportunity to go and work with Marco Pierre White when he was kind of just bursting on. Well, he was already on the scene, you know. He was a 2-star restaurant. He was the youngest chef to have 2 Michelin stars. So I moved up to London and went to work with Marco, which was an interesting experience, but something that I treasure.
Well, tell us a bit about that period. Is one of the world's most known chefs. You were the head chef at Harvey's for a number of years. Do you have any memories or stories you can tell us about what it was like working with him in that kitchen?
I used to be on tenderhooks every day going into work, thinking to myself, what's going to happen today? And, you know, he was, you know, an amazing man, and but hard and crazy. And, you know, there was times where, you know, he'd walk into the kitchen. I remember on one occasion he walked into the kitchen and he said, I don't want any more personal phone calls coming through the landline for Harvey's. And at that point, the phone rang in the kitchen, and he answered the phone, and it was for somebody in the kitchen. And he ripped the phone off the wall and smashed it up with a meat cleaver and said, do you all understand that I don't want any more personal calls? And, like, it was funny, but it was really scary. But in terms of my career, I think, you know, Marco opened a lot of doors for me, and also it gave me a really big insight into the industry, because he was so successful. And it was through a contact of his that I actually met somebody that was living in Melbourne, and I had the opportunity to come to Melbourne. And I think that, you know, you reach these kind of crossroads in your life, and you go, you know, should I go to Melbourne or should I stay working in London with Marco? And, you know, I was going to open a restaurant with Marco and, you know, be the next hot chef in London. Or do you just sort of throw caution to the wind and just drop it all and go to Melbourne? And I kind of, my dad said to me, son, you know, this is an amazing opportunity. You don't know what's going to happen. So I decided to drop it all and come to Melbourne. And you know, like, I think sometimes when you do stuff like that, you're kind of forced to really kind of, you know, get your act together. And when I got to Melbourne, I had some colleagues here that I knew from London that kind of pointed me in the right direction. And, you know, I spoke to all the big names when I got here, which was, you know, your Philippe Michels and your Jacques Ramons. And, you know, and I decided that I had a very interesting meeting with the Van Handel family at the Stoke House. And I really, really kind of was captivated by their vision of what they wanted the Stoke House to be. So I decided that I would pursue that angle. So, you know, at the ripe old age of 25, I was the head chef at the Stoke House. And it was pretty daunting as well, because when I got there, it was, you know, pretty disorganized and not that well run. So it was quite a challenge for me, not only to try and lift the standard of the food and make my own mark, but also get everything organized and get the right team and get everything running really smoothly, which was a challenge, but it was fantastic.
You won many awards with your time there. Tell us about the sort of food you were cooking then.
Well, what I wanted to do was I kind of wanted back then, you know, Melbourne had a very different landscape to what it has now. So I sort of came in doing sort of modern Australian but classic European. So it was, I had a lot of sort of French influenced dishes on the menu, and also a lot of sort of Mediterranean style dishes as well, and some Italian dishes. So it was kind of a bit of a melting pot, which is what Australia really is essentially. But that was the style then, and that was the style that I implemented. And bearing in mind it was super, super busy there, and I had to sort of create a menu that I would be able to sort of implement for the masses. And during my time at Marco's, Marco opened a restaurant in Chelsea Harbour called The Canteen, and that was kind of this great big brasserie-style restaurant. So I kind of took elements from that and mixed it into the Stoke House, which was really good, you know. It kind of elevated the Stoke House to what it should have been, you know. It was really good smart service, great wines, great drinks and great food. And I think that before I got there, there wasn't the great food element.
Circa the Prince has the most incredible alumni of chefs that came from that restaurant, which you set up way back in 1998. Tell us about the building that restaurant and what you created there and the challenges involved.
Yeah, look, that was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. I got the opportunity with the Van Handels. The Van Handels purchased the Prince of Wales and sort of came to me and said, look, you know, we've got a long-term plan with you, and what we'd like to do is to go into business with you. And we're going to be opening a signature restaurant, and we'd like you to head it up. And that's kind of where Circa was born. And, you know, it was a huge challenge for me, because I was a young man. I kind of really wasn't that experienced in kitchen design and, you know, buying furniture and bar setups and, you know, all the systems and procedures and cashing on and cashing off. It was a whole new world to me, but it was something that I was really, really interested in. And I think that the launch of Circa was, you know, probably one of the highlights of my career and the most proudest moments of my career, because it kind of was a restaurant that was really ahead of its time. I think, when it launched. And that wasn't just because of me. I think that was because of all the people involved. And, we launched this restaurant and, the interior design was amazing. The furniture was amazing. The place looked fantastic. And as soon as we opened, it was just boom. We were busy.
Well, it ended up winning Best New Restaurant, 3 chef's hats. What sort of pressures were on you and how did you deal with the pressures of that sort of success?
I did put a lot of pressure on myself, and I was just kind of just doing what I do and trying to surround myself with the right people in order for the restaurant to achieve the goals that I wanted it to achieve. And, I was so humbled that we was nominated for Gourmet Traveller Restaurant of the Year in our first year. We won 3 chef's hats. We won Best New Restaurant in the Age Good Food Guide. It was quite a journey. And, very, very difficult to sort of keep your feet on the ground and keep focused on what the long-term objective was. But an amazing time, hard work. But, I think that back then, in the style of food that I was cooking, I was really, really, really happy, like modern Australian food, 3 chef's hats, using all the best produce that I wanted to use. It was a brilliant time.
Your interest in food started to change a couple of years on from that, and Taxi Dining Room sort of marked your sort of push into Asian influences on your cooking. Why did that happen?
I think that's a really interesting question, Anthony. I think like everything in the world, everything moves fast. Look at technology. Look at mobile phones. The way that they've grown in the last 20 years. And I think that the hospitality industry and food is very, very similar. When I landed in Australia, it was very cafe cultured, Italian. And, then it went through this kind of more European French style. And I just noticed that people's eating habits had changed, and there was a lot more kind of Asian people starting to come into Melbourne, into Australia, the whole multicultural side. And it was kind of like, the food that I'm cooking was really kind of inspired from the French cuisine, from my time working with Marco and my time working with Mr. Roux. And it was kind of like, you need to change it up, Michael. You need to look at what you're doing, and you need to be a bit more innovative and come up with something that's going to be sustainable for a long time. So I just kind of decided that it was time to reinvent myself. And, by then I'd been at Circa for 5 or 6 years, I can't remember, and I had an option to get out, as you do, as I was a partner there. I had an option to get bored out, and I took that option, and I had a little bit of time off and had a think about what I wanted to do. And then all of a sudden Taxi just came along, and Taxi is probably the best restaurant I've ever been involved in with Paul Mathis. And, I think that that was just great. The design, I'd done some research on the food. I had like all this like Japanese, Asian style food, but all food that was really, really well sourced, really, really well cooked. I had a great team that sort of followed me from Circa, and bang, that was just unbelievable. That was just something that only dreams are made of, when you get into an environment like that and you've got the synergy of all the people that are all pressing in the right direction. And, to win Restaurant of the Year in our first year at Taxi was just, you know, unbelievable.
What was it like for you, a chef trained in classical French and European techniques, trying to bring in Japanese techniques and ingredients? Were there challenges involved in that sort of evolution?
Undoubtedly. Look, it's really hard, and you know, like the Asian flavors are dealt with differently. And I was lucky enough to work with a couple of very good Japanese chefs. Kin-san, who was a Japanese chef there, showed me the way to go with using the Japanese produce, and I had a real kind of affinity with Thai flavors as well. So I was going to cooking classes in Thailand, learning about Thai food. And I think it's just an evolution, you know. You've just got to, I think that you can always use, like I do now, it's like you've always got the principles of the French cuisine, but you marry that with some Thai flavors, with some Japanese flavors, and you've just got to get it right. And you know, that's my style.
You also embarked and created a few gastro pubs as well, veering away from the Asian sort of influence that you were immersing yourself with. Tell us a bit about the modern gastro pub and what it took to build those.
Yeah, look, I always had this obviously coming from England and obviously coming from a pub background, I always thought to myself that a modern pub in Australia would work really well. And, you know, it has to be a really nice environment inside with really good food, but really good pub food. And I'm not talking like Palmer's and stuff. I'm talking like really good, smart, well-executed pub food with good ingredients. And I kind of thought with a really good wine list, but not too expensive, and some good drinks and some good beers, you could create something really fantastic. And while I was at Taxi, I got an opportunity. I met an amazing woman called Pam Lamaro, who opened she sort of shared my vision. She opened a pub in South Melbourne called Lamaro's, after her name. And she asked me to get involved with her. And after a bit of deliberation, and obviously I spoke with the people from Taxi, and I jumped at the chance, and we turned that into exactly what my vision was. And we shared, like Pam and I shared the same vision, and we created an amazing gastro pub with great food, great drinks. And that was something that I absolutely loved. I loved it there. But business is business, and a big corporation came along and wanted to buy us. So we sold out, and it was really sad actually, but you know, business is business, and you've got to do what you've got to do. So sold out of Lamaro's, and within, I don't know, 4 months of selling out of Lamaro's, I decided that it was time to do the next generation of Lamaro's, which was, you know, something that was bigger, something that had bigger event spaces, something that I could sort of develop the food and do a different style of food. And that's where the Smith was born. And look, that was an incredible journey, the Smiths. We created this. Sorry, it's funny when I think about it. But I had an amazing team that came with me. At that stage, I'd decided to get myself out of Taxi as well. So I had sort of a 12-month break. And a lot of the people from Taxi followed me, both kitchen and front of house. And the Smith was a really, really good acquisition into the sort of hospitality sector of Paran. It was, really good food. I'd say sort of not pub food, but like elevated pub food. And we had a really good focus on really good cocktails, and we had a fantastic wine list. And, you know, within sort of 3 weeks of opening the doors, the Smith just took off. It was an absolute monster. It was like, you know, it was actually scary going into work because it was that busy.
Your fascination with Asian cuisine led to the opening of Lucy Liu, one of the busiest and noisiest restaurants in Melbourne. Tell us about that restaurant and where that idea came from.
Well, yeah, look, I got an opportunity to buy into, I think it was a French restaurant called PM24. I think the maid, anyway, I got an opportunity to buy in. And I always had this idea. I remember that I went to Chin Chin when Chin Chin first opened, and it blew my socks off. And it blew my socks off not because I thought that the food was amazing, like the food's really good and you know, the techniques are great, but just the whole operation of it and the thought process behind it. And it was kind of like, you know what, this is the future. This is the future. This is the style. This is the style that people want. And, you know, the ambience and the energy and, you know, delicious food. And I kind of thought that in that little pocket to do a kind of Asian style restaurant and not, you know, not the same as Chin Chin or not the same as anybody else, with our own sort of unique identity, it could be a real sort of, you know, crackerjack restaurant. And I did a lot of research on food. I went with the architect that I hired to do the renovation with Lucy Liu. I went to Shanghai, Hong Kong, and we sort of all got inspired with different styles of food. And I think in all honesty, Anthony, I think Lucy Liu, and I suppose it's because it came a bit later in my career, Lucy Liu was the number one restaurant that I've ever been involved with where we've absolutely nailed every single element. The design was superb. Yes, the restaurant's really noisy, but we had it soundproof. So, you know, you and I could sit in the middle of the restaurant and we could have a conversation like this and the music could be at 120 decibels. You know, it's got the ambience, but it's also got that great soundproofing. The food, the menu that I developed was amazing, and, you know, it was just perfect. I think that rather than chefs normally cook the food that they want to cook, I think at Lucy Liu, I created a menu and cooked the food that I knew everyone would love. And it was like a menu of crowd pleasers, let's say. And, you know, it was just where all the elements come. And look, I have to give credit to a lot of people that was involved in Lucy Liu with me. It was a real team effort. And I had a lot of people that had even worked at Taxi back in the day and at the Smith. They all came. So, like, we had a huge team and synergy that was all on board with the concept. And I think that when you can get it right from all the different elements, that's when you hit that sort of Chin Chin style, you know, that's when it works. So it was a great thing to be involved in. It was unbelievable. So
how do you see the food scene at the moment? Where are the opportunities?
Well, look, I mean the food scene at the moment, it's very, very, very tough. You know, I think that obviously the Asian sector is working really, really well. And, you know, there's a number of restaurants that are cooking modern Australian food really, really well as well. What's the next thing? I don't know. I think that Australia being multicultural, I look at the Indian influence. I think that, you know, that's becoming more abundant around town. And but I think that, you know, I think that I will always stay true to my principles, and I've got I will evolve my food again and do something new. But I think that, you know, with COVID, I think that it's really sort of put a spanner in the works for a lot of businesses and a lot of people, and a lot of people have got to rethink their business model.
COVID has changed so many in the industry. What sort of impact has the last year and a half had on you?
Well, look, I've always been a bit dynamic with everything. So, again, I had an option to buy out of Lucy Liu or get bought out of Lucy Liu, and I decided that, you know, Lucy Liu was 6 years old. Maybe it's time for me to do something new. Maybe it's time for me to take a new path. So with much deliberation, I decided to sell. So December 2019, I was actually sold out of Lucy Liu, which is one of the biggest decisions of my life. But I also think that maybe it's one of the smartest decisions of my life, because, you know, who would have known that COVID was going to come? And obviously, we all know what that's done to the industry. And, you know, I've decided that I would take a bit of a break from the industry. And it actually makes me feel really bad that I have to look and watch my colleagues all struggling and speak to people every day. But I think that, you know, I think all we can do is look forward to the next thing. And I think that, you know, as an industry, we will get through this. Undoubtedly, we will get through this. But it's been devastating.
For someone that's made an incredible success out of change and evolution through your whole career, and given the last year and a half and change happening for so many in the industry, what sort of advice would you have for those about change and implementing change in their careers?
I think that the one thing that I've learned in life is nobody likes change, and everyone will do everything that they can not to change. But change is always good, and out of change, great things always happen. And I think that everyone who's listening, you know, you need to challenge yourself and get yourself out of your comfort zone and make the changes necessary, because that's how to stay alive in this industry. Constantly change.
Well, Michael, we're very honoured to have you on Deep in the Weeds today, and I know that there's many, many more stories you could share with us.
I've got a lot.
I'd love to catch up with you again perhaps later in the year and take a deep dive again, but we've loved having you on the show today.
Yeah, love to, and it's been great being on here.
Please keep in touch, and we'll catch up again soon.
Thanks, Anthony.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au.
Stay safe and be well.